The slog back through the swamp was grueling. Even in darkness, the heat and humidity were smothering. Nothing stirred, not a breath of air. The stagnant water around their legs felt tepid, like lukewarm soup. At one point, Ryan thought he heard distant blaster fire ahead of them. The cannies were popping off at something. Then it stopped. Ryan kept a close watch on the companions. Christy and JB seemed fine. Not happy about the conditions, but fine. Doc's face was flushed, his breathing labored, but he tracked a straight line through the muck. Harlan Sprue was having a much tougher time of it. Because of his weight, his boots sank deeper in the mud. Because of his girth, his body had more resistance through the water. Every step was harder for him. If Doc was breathing hard, Sprue was gasping. He was stubborn, though. Sweating like a pig, he somehow maintained the pace. As they hurried past a wide mud bank, at the edge of the lantern's glow, a pair of large, wide-set eyes tracked them. Wide-set, low-slung eyes that reflected red in the lamplight. Doc raised his hand cannon as a 15-foot-long critter swam straight for him.
Not a good choice, reptile.
The Cajun headman pushed aside the black powder blaster's muzzle.
No, don't shoot. The noise will give us away. Leave it to us.
Four of his fighters moved into position between the alligator and the Cajuns. Two had long wooden poles, and two had substantial clubs with knobbed ends. These were the band's designated gator getters. While the pair with the poles occupied the monster's fang-lined jaws, the other two stepped in and beat on its head with the clubs. They laid on alternating, sizzling blows with plenty of snap, concentrating on a precise strike point between the creature's eyes and back a couple inches. After a couple of smacks, the gator forgot what he was about. After a couple more smacks, the clubs made wet, squishy sounds on impact, which told Ryan the knob ends had to be lead-loaded. The blows crushed the bony skull and scrambled the brains within. As the clubbers quickly retreated, the gator helplessly spun and thrashed. Unable to swim or to even hold its snout out of the water, it slowly drowned. In the course of the 45-minute forced march, this scenario was repeated only two or three times.
What happened to all your gators? I thought they were as thick as flies in these parts.
The big ones are already chock full, off sleeping in the reeds.
To make his point, Luis reached into the mangroves and between two fingers, gingerly picked up a bloody shred of clothing. He sniffed at it, made a disgusted face, then tossed it back.
Wildlife put a big time whooping on them baby eaters.
They climbed up the slope to the road, along the tunnel hacked into the bush. After crawling on their bellies the last bit, they came out onto the narrow, hidden path. Having fresh air and space above felt good to Ryan. A long convoy roared down the road from the north. They let the wag zoom past, then running low, they advanced single file to the top of the hill. There was nothing waiting for them when they got there. The wags were gone. The prisoners and dead-ends gone, too. Ryan examined the crisscrossing tire tracks on the shoulder. They all pointed south, toward Vermilion Bay and La Golondrina.
The bastards got away. Are we still going after them?
Yes, we're going after them. Got to get us some wheels first. It's 20 miles to the tip of the peninsula, and another 10 across the water. Be way past sunup before we get there walking.
Set up a barricade?
Won't work. They just crashed through it. Even if we stopped a wag or two that way, they'd be in bad shape. Either wrecked or shot the sheet. Don't worry. We pulled this off a dozen times before, and it's worked perfect every time.
Cheetah Luis led Ryan and the others to the brush on the far side of the road.
Make yourselves to home.
Behind them on the road, three Cajuns handed their blasters to their comrades. Then they laid down in the middle of the tarmac. One lay on his side, one on his belly, and one on his back. Heads all pointing in different directions, legs tangled up. They looked like they had just fallen off a speeding meat wag, which was the whole idea.
These canies come back from Marsh Island are all heading back out to join the hunt. The bastards are always hungry, and they can't pass up easy pickings.
If you've run this trick so many times, how come the canies never figured out it's a trap?
None of them ever leave to tell the tale. We start fresh every time.
It didn't take long for more headlights to appear on the road from the south. A three-wag convoy rumbled their way. As it got closer, Ryan could see a dilapidated SUV in the lead and two full-size pickups behind. For a second, Carter thought they were going to roll right over the possum-playing Cajuns. Then the SUV hit the brakes, forcing the other wags to do the same. They came to a stop almost directly across from the companions' hiding place, engines idling. Ryan counted four Kennys in the metallic sand-colored SUV, backlit by the high beams from behind. The second wag had that many packed into the front seat. Eight more in the pickup's bed were spotlighted by the headlights of the last wag. He couldn't see much of the second pickup. The SUV's driver and passenger door swung open. Two scrawny females jumped out with drawn handguns. They walked around the front of their wag and looked down at the bodies caught in the headlights. The driver turned to the wags behind and waved. The Kennys hopped down from the pickup beds and cabs, and the other two passengers climbed from the SUV. As they pulled out long knives to divide the spoils, the Cajuns opened fire, angling their shots due south so as not to hit their comrades on the other side of the road. Careful to keep from hitting the tires, fuel tanks, and engine compartments, the Cajuns stitched auto-fire through the Kennys. The SUV driver and passenger went down first, hit by so many bullets that their torsos were practically cut in two. The torrent of slugs peeled the rest of the flesh-eaters off the wags and sent them crashing to the road. It was over in 15 seconds. The Kennys hadn't managed to return a single shot. The Kennys lying on the road jumped up, and those hiding in the brush stepped out from concealment. They quickly turned over the Kennys' bodies, making sure they were dead. Cheetah Luis looked into the SUV's driver door for a second.
Check the gas tanks. We got plenty of gas here.
The other wags were full up, too. Cheetah Luis waved his machete.
Get the bodies off the road.
As his fighters began dragging the corpses into the brush, Luis knelt over one of the dead. He stretched out the arms on the tarmac. Then, with two deft chops of the machete, severed both hands at the wrist.
Why did you do that? Are you taking trophies?
Nah.
Cheetah Luis shook the blood off the stumps and laid the hands on the SUV's floorboards in front of the driver's seat.
Meat wags always give out free samples.
When the road was clear of corpses, Cheetah Luis divided his fighters and the companions among the three wags. JB, Doc, and Sprue laid down in the first pickup's bed with five Cajuns and played dead. Ryan and Christy got in the SUV with Cheetah Luis. Carter took the shotgun seat with the Steyr propped between his knees. Christy sat behind him in the rear. Beside her was Lila, the Cajun's chubby lieutenant. Cheetah Luis K-turned the SUV, then headed south. The other wags followed him. Ryan stuck his head out the window and let the wind whip over his face. The rush of air felt cool through his sweaty hair. Overhead, the stars were disappearing behind a blanket of cottony clouds. The road was deserted. They traveled down a narrow tunnel created by the SUV's high beams. Ryan actually drifted off to sleep despite the jolting of the wag. He awoke every time a convoy heading north whooshed past. It didn't happen often, and he managed to sneak some much-needed rest. Half an hour later, Cheetah Luis tapped the brakes. Ahead of them was a string of red taillights. 10 other wags were stopped on the road. No doubt the convoy they'd seen barreling over the hilltop. Beyond the wags was the foot of a bridge that spanned a wide strip of dark water. A mile or more was Ryan's guess.
We've got to go over that bridge.
Looks like somebody's directing traffic.
First one way, then the other.
What about the people in the back of the trucks?
They'll be just fine as long as they stay down and don't move. The Kennys won't look at them that close. They've been the top dogs around here so long they don't expect this kind of trouble coming in their front door.
As they crept toward the bridge, Ryan saw a battered signpost beside the road that read Intercoastal Waterway. When they were three wags from the Kenny directing traffic with an AK-47, Ryan got a good look at the looming structure. There was no guardrail on the right lane. No right lane either. That side of the pre-dark bridge had fallen off into the water. As they waited their turn to cross, Ryan took in the Kenny traffic cop. He was bug-eyed, with long, greasy hair, a fat, pale face, and wispy, dirty blonde beard. He wore a long, cream-colored duster and knee-high rubber boots. The canny shifted the assault rifle from sling to hand and swaggered toward them.
Shit. Leave this to me. Don't do anything. Don't say a word.
Cheetah Luis waved out his open window and smiled as the canny stepped up. pointing the muzzle of his AK toward the sky.
Nice night for a luau.
The Cajun jerked a thumb at the truck lined up behind him.
Brought along the appetizers.
Damn, I love finger food.
Lots of tools back there, too.
The traffic director reached under his coat and pulled out a pair of long-handled side cutters.
Mind if I snip off a couple? Been a long time since I had my dinner. Don't know when I'm going to get my next meal.
Why don't I just give you a hand?
Cheetah Luis reached down to the floorboards for one of the pair he had removed. He passed it out the window.
That's fresh as they come.
Thanks.
No problem, we got plenty.
You can go on ahead now. Take it slow. Keep well to the left. That bridge ain't what it used to be.
See you later.
The Kenny mock saluted Cheetah Luis with a severed hand.
Y'all drive safe now.
Flesh-eating asshole. Cheetah Luis shifted into second gear and left it there. The bridge didn't start to shake until all three wags were on it. Ryan could hear the structural stress over the sound of the engines. And he could hear stuff falling off, chunks of concrete and asphalt splashing into the water below. When they reached the other side, the Cajun shifted to third, then fourth. The SUV rapidly picked up speed. Beyond the traffic, waiting its turn at the foot of the bridge, the road ahead was empty. The three-wag convoy traveled without incident for 7 more miles. Then they came up over a rise that revealed the end of the road. And more. Across a wide, black bay, Ryan could see orange lights dancing on the far horizon. Bonfires, he thought. And they had to be huge to be visible this far away.
Is that it?
That's it.
Long swim.
From where Mildred sat, she could see rows of headlights sweeping past on the two-lane highway, lighting up the abandoned meat wags parked on the shoulder. Ahead of Mildred, the Cannies were dragging the bodies and parts bags down the side of the road. Circumstances dictated that they had to do their own dirty work. They hadn't tried to force the Cajun prisoners to haul the dead. With the extra weight and their bound ankles, they would have moved even more slowly, allowing any pursuit the chance to catch up. And if the Cannies had cut the ankle ties, their captives would have scattered for the brush in all directions, and many would have gotten away. Even though the ropes on Mildred's feet were soaked, the knots hadn't loosened a bit. She had rope burns on the outside of her ankles from the friction of the long march. En route, alligators had taken down Cannies in spectacular fashion. If, as Cheetah Luis had said, live canny butt smelled like fresh-baked bread to gators, dead Cajuns had to have smelled like raspberry jam. The reptiles ignored the bound prisoners and ripped away corpses, tow ropes, and corpse pullers. These were huge animals, possibly mutated, well over 20 feet long, easily 800 pounders. And they were hell-bent on dinner. Streams of bullets only angered them. The Cannies who stood their ground and kept shooting got their heads crushed to pulp by the monster's back teeth. That tactic was abandoned after the first disastrous try. All they could do was flee while the beasts were otherwise occupied with the unlucky. At the head of the line of parked wags were three full-size pickups. The Cannies hoisted the corpses by their hands and feet and swung them into the beds. Beyond the pickups were three small semi-tractor trailers. The trailers were vented with thousands of holes. In pre-dark times, they had been used to haul cattle to slaughter. The Cannies shoved and booted their shell-shocked, bitten and bleeding captives up the rear ramps and into the trailers. There were already people inside the first trailer, waiting. They got shoved to the front as the Cannies packed in the newcomers. It was either stand up or be stepped on. Mildred looked into the dirty faces. Some were frightened. Some were blank, dead-eyed. The ones who had already given up. It smelled bad, and not just from fear sweat. The wags had been sitting on the side of the road while the Cannies went hunting for more victims to top off their load. The trailer's grated floor could have served as a toilet if the people inside hadn't been bound hand and foot. As it happened, the only toilet was in their pants. Apparently the Cannies weren't going to wait around for the cave crew to join them. Not in this neighborhood. If the companions were coming to rescue them, they were too late, Mildred thought. She and Jack were on their own, to the bitter end. The cattle wag lurched forward onto the road. The bodies crammed inside swayed into one another. With hands tied behind them, the prisoners couldn't avoid the contact. The steady vibration of the wheels on pavement rattled up through the metal floor and walls. The glare of headlights from behind poured through the trailer's holes. The captive Cajuns had banded together, shoulder to shoulder, them against the world. Even though Jack stood beside Mildred, she couldn't see his pupils. She didn't know if he had suffered a serious head injury. The bleeding from his scalp had stopped, leaving a crusty scab in his snow-white scalp.
How's your head, Jack?
Hi, Tim.
Seeing double? Feeling weak?
Nope. Mildred felt better upon hearing that. It meant he probably didn't have a concussion.
They gonna pay.
Jack's forehead was smooth. He wasn't frightened. He wasn't angry. He was determined. Many times Mildred had seen him dance the dance, slipping like a shadow between attacking adversaries, killing with his leaf-bladed knives and that big Colt of his. She also knew Jack could get down to business with much less. A piece of sharp metal, a chunk of concrete, a length of power cord. If he had his hands free... Standing there, packed in like a sardine, with the breeze blocked by hot bodies, Mildred started feeling sick again. Hot, jangly, weak, maybe even a little scared. She had to get her mind on something else. She turned to the skinny young woman leaning against her right side.
Where are you from?
Does it matter?
In the glare of headlights, Mildred saw matted hair, thick makeup, and garish lipstick, mascara smeared into raccoon eyes. The woman wore a short skirt that barely covered her bottom and a flimsy blouse. Her high-top black sneakers were laced with electrical wire. There were fresh and old bruises on her thighs and knees and on her bare arms.
Cannies do that to you?
No. Paying customers riled up on Jolt did that. Working in a gaudy house is a shitty life. They like to pound with their fists while they're pounding you with the other thing. I made a funny.
Yeah.
The woman tilted her head around Mildred to look at Jack.
He a muty? How come he's so white?
Got hit hard in the head, made him go pale.
Made his eyes all bloody like that, too?
Mm-hmm.
Can he still see?
Sure.
He's not a stoop, is he? You're not a stoop, are you?
He understands what you're saying. You don't have to shout.
Can talk, too.
Jack smiled a crooked smile. Then his face went as blank as an empty page.
I come from Texas. That's where the cannies got me. Shot all hell out of the gaudy I was working in. Walked in the door and started blasting away. I was under a customer at the time, big old boy. He got hit in the back, died right on top of me. Cannies pulled him off and loaded him in a wag with the rest of the dead. Put me in this trailer.
Everybody here come from Texas?
We're from Arkansas.
Louisiana.
Sippy. We've been on the road for 2 weeks. Rained on. Shit on, pissed on, starved.
Mildred looked up at the trailer roof. It, too, was ventilated.
Bastards pour the crap food they feed us through them holes. Make us fight for it like animals.
Hard to fight with your hands tied.
Hard to eat, too. Most of it falls through the floor.
We only got one thing going in our favor.
What's that?
Damn cannies gotta eat all the dead'uns before they can eat us. We won't spoil, but the dead'uns will.
Wedged in behind Mildred was a fat merchant. Beside him was a little parakeet of a woman. Her stare was fixed, like a doll's.
Michelle's been like that ever since we got taken. She don't eat, don't sleep. She just stares like that. She hardly ever blinks. I keep telling myself maybe it's all for the best. Maybe she won't feel it when they start to chill her. Then I get scared and I think maybe she'll come out of it right when the pain starts.
The woman was textbook catatonic. Trauma and terror had caused her mind to crash in on itself. The prognosis was grim.
What did you do in Sippy?
We sold this and that from our shack in Poplarville. Scavenged pretty dark items, mostly. Farm tools, weapons, ammo, black powder. Also did a good trade in tobacco and joy juice. Me and Michelle worked the shack inside Poplarville for 10 years. Had lots of friends thereabouts. No complaints about my fairness. I'm not a hard dealer. Too easy was what Michelle always said. But I figured life's too short to do people harsh. Not that it mattered in the end. Cannies came and took it all away. Ran the gate with a 6x6 wag. Jumped out of the back and started chilling. They shot down the folks with blasters right away. than use their knives on anyone still fighting. I've seen firsthand what they done to my friends and neighbors after they were dead. They cut them like hogs round the neck and let the blood drain out. Strung them up by the feet and let it drip on the ground. Cannies aren't like us. They aren't human. They look at someone hurting, maybe screaming, and it gives them joy. When they smell blood and guts, it don't make them sick. It makes them hungry.
Try to relax. Breathe deep and slow. You can't help Michelle if you give yourself a heart attack.
Mildred turned away. She couldn't help him. She couldn't help herself. Dust thrown up by the wags in front filtered through the trailer's ventilated roof and walls in a steady stream. The constant vibration and the noise numbed the captives. Some of them actually slept on their feet, held up by the bodies around them. Mildred knew they were heading south, so when the convoy stopped at the foot of the bridge, she could guess what it spanned. The Intercoastal Waterway, a highway for boat traffic, commercial and recreational, before the apocalypse. After a few minutes, the cattle wag pulled onto the ruined bridge and crossed the wide channel at a crawl. Because of the low speed, there was little dust to eat. The air smelled of salt and sea. The Gulf of Mexico was close at hand. They drove for another quarter of an hour, then stopped again. This time, with wag engines idling and headlights blazing, the rear doors of Mildred's trailer opened, and cannies climbed in, pulling, shoving, forcing their prisoners to hobble down the ramp. In headlights, Mildred could see the black water of the gulf, the shoreline, and a makeshift dock. Tied to the dock was a motorized barge, the kind used to haul gravel or sand. While the prisoners were lined up single file, one by one, the pickups backed up to the bow of the barge. Then the cannies rolled the dead ends off tailgates onto the deck. Next to one of the pickups, Mildred saw Junior Thibodeau. The scar-faced canny was evidently back in his master's good graces. He stood beside the canny commander, grinning. When the dead were loaded, the living were marched down to the water and onto the boat. The trough-like foredeck was heaped with corpses. The captives were herded toward the tiny wheelhouse at the opposite end. They stood there, sweating. On the horizon, Mildred could see the fires burning on Marsh Island. She had never been there, but she had read something about it in a magazine. Some controversy about the drilling of a natural gas well on the edge of a state wildlife refuge. It wasn't the kind of place tourists went. There were no hotels, no residences. It had no scenic charm unless you liked bugs, gators, and snakes. It was just a lump of marshy land sticking up out of the gulf. When the cargo was safely on board, the cannies cast off the lines and the barge backed away from the dock. For a second, caustic diesel smoke billowed over the deck. Then the barge turned and motored forward, heading for the distant firelights. The water was as smooth as a black mirror. The barge made good time. The wind rushing over the open deck cooled down the huddled captives. When they were about 2 miles off the island, Mildred smelled something wafting from the shore. Wood smoke and roasting meat. The instant she was hit by that odor, stark, grainy images flooded her mind. Images of Auschwitz and Rwanda, her only frames of reference. But this was worse than the genocides of a century ago. Worse, because the mass killing wasn't the end of it. The killing was just the beginning of the evil. The smell engulfed the barge. There was no escape from it. When she breathed through her mouth, she could taste it in the back of her throat. To her horror, out of the blue, she began to salivate.
Fight it! Fight it! Fight it!
Mildred dug her nails into her palms until tears came to her eyes. She focused on the sharp pain until her head stopped spinning. The barge ducked into a cove on the island's northeast corner, the entrance bracketed by bonfires. Dense plumes of smoke rose straight up into the still night air. The captives were ushered out onto the narrow beach. Above the sloping shelf of white sand, the land was as flat as a tabletop. After the bodies had been dumped on the sand, the cannies moved among the captives, using knives to cut through the ankle ropes that hobbled them. It wasn't an act of kindness, because there was nowhere to run. It was so they could tow the dead. Junior Thibodeau put the loops of rope in Jack's and Mildred's hands. He seemed quite pleased with himself, kicking Jack in the butt to urge him on.
Giddy up! Yeah.
As they climbed the slope to the flatland, they didn't look back at who they were dragging. Rubbery, human-shaped bags of bones. Atop the table of land, there wasn't a single tree in sight. There was no cover above ground. She and Jack followed a dirt path polished slick by dredges of human skin and bone. In the leaping light of the fires, Mildred observed the terrain on either side of the track. It was irregular, potholed with standing water and probably quicksand. Drainage cuts brimming with brine crisscrossed the plain, and there were large ponds. In the daytime, Marsh Island could be swarming with mosquitoes, deer flies, and no-see-ums. It was the kind of place where alligators happily bred and grew fat. Mixed with the smell of meat cooking was the stench of rotting fish and rotting vegetation. Far ahead, Mildred could see dots of elevated light that marked a structure. The light was too dim to see the exact outlines, but given the distance, it had to be enormous. With their canny minders following, the prisoners trudged on over the winding path. It took a long time to get close enough to the structure to clearly make it out. Mildred figured they had walked about 5 miles, towing a dead weight, when she recognized the immense hulking shape of a grounded, ocean-going freighter. Torches burning along the rails and bonfires on the marsh below illuminated it. A jumble of steel cargo containers had spilled from its deck onto the marsh. They were the source of the vile Swedish aroma. The Kennys had converted them into smokehouses. This was where the flesh-eaters cured their road food. About 100 yards from the ship, the dirt path turned gleaming white. It looked like it was paved with alabaster cobblestones. Only when Mildred was actually standing on it did she realize she was walking on the tops of human skulls. Thousands upon thousands of them. Too many for this operation to have produced. They had to have been collected from the neutron-bombed coast, from the emptied, intact buildings. As the captives passed the cargo containers, Mildred looked inside one of the open doorways. Glistening red corpses hung on crosspoles by their heels, arms trussed behind their backs. The bodies had been shaved of all hair. The eyeballs were cooked white. A canny standing in the doorway dipped a short-handled rag mop in a bucket of reddish liquid, then basted the corpses with it. Around and between the containers, other cannies danced, whirling, staggering as if drunk. Their faces, hair, and beards were shiny with grease, their eyes wild with delight. Piles of stripped clean rib and thigh bones lay scattered at their feet.
I'm scared. I don't want to end up like that.
A little late to start worrying. You won't know what they done to you after you're gone.
I can't help but think about it. About them touching me and pulling my meat from the bones and...
Shut the hell up!
Mildred had no more sympathy to give.
Oh.
A bonfire raged behind her eyes. Every time she breathed in, it felt like she was inhaling molten lava into her lungs. Her mind raced in looping, alarming circles of rationalization and depravity. She was losing her grip on every moral value she had ever claimed. She could feel herself dissolving into something unspeakable. That idea hammered inside the walls of her head. She couldn't push it aside or throttle it. She couldn't deny it. Mildred would have fallen on her knees and begged Jack to kill her then and there, but there was no way he could comply with his hands tied behind his back. She flung aside the tow rope, jumped from the trail, and took off across the marsh. She could have run faster, but she wasn't trying to get away. She was hoping to catch a mercy bullet in the back. The cannies did open fire, but only to send a couple of warning shots over her head. When she didn't stop, they chased her down and tackled her, driving her into a shallow pond. They jerked her to her feet, and while one bastard held her arms, the other started slapping her in the face. Using the canny at her back for leverage, she kicked him in the stomach. Reaching behind her back, she got her hands on the other canny's privates and squeezed as hard as she could. He doubled over, gasping for air. When he straightened, she headbutted him a solid blow. By which time, the first canny had recovered. Grabbing her shoulder, he again flung her down into the pond. He put his boot sole on her chest, pinning her on her back.
Not all you got, you big, brave baby eaters! You're nothing but Julie's, a lot of you brave, damaged pieces of shit!
Suicide by proxy was what she was after. The cannies had no intention of giving it to her. Meat on the hoof was worth a lot more to them than meat on a rope. They hauled her up by her armpits, dragged her to the path, and shoved her back in line next to Jack. Junior picked up the end of the tow rope and put it in her hand.
You dropped something, Mildred.
The beating had cleared Mildred's head. There was a stinging cut inside her mouth. She tasted her own blood. She felt almost herself again.
I'm glad you didn't try to help, Jack.
Couldn't. Scarface can't have Python against head. You wanna die?
Better to die than turn into one of them.
Better to chill some of them first. Pick the time and the place.
Mildred didn't know how much time she had. That was the problem. At least Jack was offering hope, even if it was just for some token retribution.
Okay. Chill some first.
The line of corpse haulers moved on, creeping toward the flank of the grounded freighter. Mildred speculated that the terrible tsunamis that followed the apocalypse had lifted the great ship over the sandy strip of beach and deposited it, high and dry, on top of the marshland, where it had sat for more than 100 years. Its main deck and superstructure faced them, canted at about 30 degrees from vertical. The Cannies, or more likely their prisoners, had constructed a crude ramp of hard-packed dirt that led from the ground to the freighter's midship gangway. On the edge of the bridge wing, lit by torches, she saw a female figure. She could make out long, dark hair, white skin, black clothing. The woman was waving her slender arms at the dancing, weaving throng 6 stories below her. On the freighter's main deck, Cannies cavorted in long lines up and down the gunwales. It was a celebration. A love fest. Ten wagloads of Canny victims either shuffled under their own power or were dragged by their dead heels onto the waiting barge. With all the prisoners and bodies and the attending Cannies, things were chaotic at the water's edge, which made it easy for the Cajuns and companions to slip on board. There was no longer a reason for any of them to play dead, no reason for the Cannies to think they were anything but their own dear brethren. Cannies not in terminal stage Uzis looked exactly like Norms. It was a natural camouflage that allowed them to slip into vills unnoticed and do their worst. The hellscape was crawling with filthy, mean, and ruthless sons of bitches. For Norms to accurately pick Cannies out of a crowd, they had to see the bastards in action, taking an unholy delight in the killing. And, of course, in the eating that came afterward. The difference between Norm and Canny was internal, not external. It was behavior. In this case, the requisite Canny mimicking wasn't the killing of the innocent or feeding on human flesh, but in doing nothing to free the ranks of poor, doomed prisoners. Doing nothing under the circumstances was hard. Ryan stood next to the tightly packed, trussed human cargo. Men and women, but no children. Cannies ate the children first. The captives were battered, bruised, bitten. Their clothing hung in shreds. The prisoners either looked at their own bound feet or stared off into the black distance. They wouldn't meet a Canny's gaze for fear of being killed on the spot. They understood they were caught in the grip of pure evil. It appeared that the easy part was going to be getting in. All around Ryan, Cajuns with loaded assault rifles sat on heavy packs crammed full of ammo and explosives. No one in charge bothered to check them or the contents of their luggage. Finding out what they had under their butts wouldn't have produced an alarm anyway. Cannies carried blasters, ammo, and explosives all the time. It was how they made their daily bread.
Where's your meat?
Ryan turned to face a big, raw-boned woman. She wore her coarse, white-streaked hair in a braid as thick as a mooring line. Her chisel-edged front teeth were the color of sulfur, she had a bulbous nose, and there was a spray of whiskers on her chin. She wore her blaster, a 20-gauge Ithaca stakeout pump gun, on a lanyard around her neck. The muzzle dangled between her trouser-clad legs, suggestive of another distinctive male feature. The front of her duster was decorated with black blotches of dried blood.
In a pile at the other end of the barge.
Got any near goners in your pack?
Nah, nobody's that bad off.
You're lucky. 3 of mine are laying over there half dead. Haven't taken the cure yet.
Ryan glanced over at the sick Cannies. They were sitting on the deck with their backs leaning against the low gunwale, barely able to hold up their heads. Gray spindles of mucus connected their noses to their chins, and their chins to their chests.
Not a pretty sight. They're too weak to hunt. Have to hand feed them. Go on, Luther, give them some more!
The canny standing next to the terminal cases reached into a parts bag and pulled out a handful of something slimy and tubular. He pressed down on a gray smeared chin to open the mouth and packed in the goodies.
Used to be we'd chill them when they got like that. We'd crack their heads and eat the brains for pudding.
Yeah. The fully loaded barge backed away from the dock, then reversed course and headed for the firelights on the horizon.
Know why?
Sure, they were checking out anyway. Might as well put the meat to good use.
Nah. We'd do it even when we weren't hungry. Even when we had some fresh chilled hanging close by. We did it because looking at them poor, weak, sick fucks, we were seeing ourselves, how we'd end up, and we were scared shitless, and purely hating every minute of it. We was like a dog biting off its own tail out of pure cussedness. La Galandrina changed all that. She freed us from the gray death. She pulled us together and made us a people, made us a canny nation. La Galandrina is our life, our hope.
It confirmed one of Ryan's long-standing beliefs. One person's hope was somebody else's hell on wheels.
None of my crew has taken the cure, but we're all about to. We've never been here before. Come a long ways to get the job done.
She'll do more than stop your nose from dripping, One Eye. She'll get inside you and wind up your spring, I guarantee it. The sound of her voice is something you will never forget as long as you live. It thrills the soul. It makes you want to march to her call.
She's the one who planned all this, right? Took some doing, some brains. Does she ever hunt the road?
Not anymore. She don't come out during the day much. I've never seen her up close myself. She stays on the bridge of her ship. It's like a tower. When the medicine's ready, it's brought down to the deck and passed around to the pilgrims.
You ever been up in that tower?
Nobody's allowed up there except her special guards. The same one she's took up with when she first got here. Her original pack. Angels of Death, she calls them. They aren't folks to mess with. Got no sense of humor, believe me. They carry these big old swords with curved blades. Razor sharp from tip to basket.
Cutlasses?
Yeah, that's it. One swipe and your head's off clean. Or split in two. Crown to chin. Still sitting on your neck.
Thanks. I'll keep a lookout for them.
That ship is the only shelter on the island. It's where we all stay during the pilgrimage. We store the live and dead meat inside the cargo holds. Dead meat stays fresh about a week after gutting and bleeding.
Ship don't float from what I hear.
Ain't going anywhere, that's for sure. It's sitting on mostly dry land, except for the bottom, which is buckled some. The ship came through the sky dark in good shape. It's rusting in places because we got no paint, but the hull's so thick it'd take another 100 years to wear through. There's plenty of fuel oil left in its bunkers, and gasoline, too. It was part of the pre-dark cargo. We use it to fuel the convoys.
Ryan was suddenly all too aware of the doomed ones standing behind him, their heads down, eyes closed, listening as the hag merrily jabbered away. He could imagine how sick at heart they were, knowing she would be jabbering on tomorrow, and they and those they loved would be humble pie. The Kenny with the parts bag wandered over to them.
You want some?
The stumpy bastard held up a handful of wet, gray intestine. Ryan didn't flinch.
No thanks, I just ate. Gotta go check on my crew.
See you later.
Count on it.
Christy, JB, and Sprue were up in the barge's bow, bent over, tinkering with their gear, and trying their best not to pay attention to what was going on behind them. Doc was clearly having trouble ignoring the situation. Head lowered, he paced up and down the length of the starboard side deck in long, impatient strides. As he did so, he kept shifting his ebony sword stick from one hand to the other. Ryan could read the body language and the facial expression as Doc took in the lounging, carefree cannies. He wanted to draw his rapier blade and do some well-placed stabbing. Ryan stopped the time traveler with a hand and pulled him aside.
You've got to get a hold of yourself, Doc, or you're going to get us all chilled.
We are crossing the River Styx. On the far side, the gates of hell await.
Doc, you're...
Do you know what this presages? Do you have any idea? Brian, this goes beyond the pale of mere recreational savagery, of the diversionary barbarism to which we have become hardened. This horror is biblical in its scope. What we face is irrefutable evidence that Satan not only exists, that he walks our cursed earth in human form.
You know I don't believe in those pre-dark tales, Doc. I can't believe in something I can't see. Look around for Nuke's sake. This is exactly what people do to each other. What they've always done to each other.
No, not so, my boy.
Any evil that humankind can imagine will come to pass. The slaughter of defenseless millions, the flame out of 2,000 years of civilization, the destruction of the planet. All products of the hand of man. No devil required.
In that case, I'm afraid we are utterly lost. There is no hope of victory or salvation. If this evil resides inside us all, we can never escape it. That you could think such a thing sorely grieves me, my dear friend.
In your time and in Mildred's, people still believed that something could stand between them and their black deeds. A buffer, an explanation, a robed ritual. A way to lift the weight of their guilt for actions or inactions. An illusion to give them comfort so they could keep on doing what they were doing in good conscience. This is my time, Doc, and I don't need that kind of comfort. I bear no guilt for the blood I've shed in the past and the blood I'll shed tonight. I have the right to survive because I breathe.
Brian patted the butt of his holstered SIG.
My only salvation lies here.
Then tell me why we are crossing this water to do battle, if in the end the entire enterprise is pointless, if humanity is already doomed by its own corrupt nature.
You know the answer to that, because our friends have a right to survive too.
Yes, of course. Mildred and Jack. Mildred and Jack. We must recover them. Ryan, daily I am reminded that I have lived far too long for my own good. That what I am being forced to witness and take part in is something I was never meant to see, let alone comprehend.
Accept it and move on. It's the hand you've been dealt. You can't change it.
Yes, yes. That is the only way to proceed.
Christy stepped up beside Ryan as Doc drifted slowly away, apparently lost in sober reflection.
Is he gonna be all right?
I don't know. It might not matter.
Before she could ask for more details, Cheetah Luis joined them.
Stay together after we land. Let the captives go ahead of us.
What's the terrain gonna be like?
It's as flat as the bottom of a washtub. Mostly salt marsh. Soft muck covered with seagrass. You don't want to step off the path. Take my word for it. We lost some brave fighters that way.
Ahead, bonfires framed the entrance to the landing cove. When the bow of the barge crunched up against the bank, the canny crew jumped out and made the bowlines fast, tying them to clustered wooden posts driven deep into the sand. Standing on the deck, Ryan could see over the level of the beach. He stared at a featureless plain dotted by towering blazes. In the distance, far to the south, a string of orange points of light winked at him. Elevated points of light, defining a vague, hulking shape. The Queen's freighter.
Why didn't they put us ashore over there?
There is no place to land a boat on the southeast tip of the island. If they tried, they'd run aground a mile or two offshore, have to wade in from there, and deal with all the gators and sharks. That's why we walk.
In groups of three and four, the prisoners were shoved off the bow and onto the sand. Some tripped and fell when they hit, knocking others down. Cannies with machetes moved through their ranks, chopping through their ankle restraints. Under any other circumstances, that would have been a positive development. The cannies put tow ropes in the prisoners' hands and forced them at blaster point to drag corpses up the sand to the path. They weren't concerned about the captives running away. They wanted them to be able to take longer steps, thereby hauling the bodies faster. When Ryan and the others mounted the path at the end of the line, they glimpsed a grim, sodden landscape. A marsh pocked with pools of water. Fingers of it crept trickling downhill into the sea. There was not only nowhere to run, there was nowhere to hide.
Gators out there in the marsh. That's where the real monsters come to breed. The 30-footers. They don't like it one bit when you come near their nests. And there's quicksand and plenty of poison snakes, too. During the day, the biting bugs come down on your head like a sack and suck you dry.
Why didn't La Golondrina move off this stinking pile of shit after she got control of part of the mainland?
Who knows what she thinking or planning? I tell you one thing, it's a rad blasted place to attack. We learned that the hard way. Have to come by water. It's the only route. Have to carry everything you need on your back, and when you run out, you're shit out of luck. There's no cover to fight behind on the way in, and she's got that steel ship to pull back and hide in. No reason for the bitch to budge an inch.
Maybe she's waiting until Canny's control the whole hellscape to make her move. Then she can sail across the gulf on that barge and step ashore the Queen of the Deathlands.
A canny nation, Ryan thought, but didn't say. He didn't have to. They were all thinking the same thing.
Sooner or later, there won't be any more humans left. What are the stinking bastards gonna eat when that happens?
Maybe they're not thinking that far ahead.
Maybe they are, and we just don't know what they've got in mind.
Well, maybe then they'll start eating each other. Oh, that'd be sweet. Too bad none of us will be around to see it.
By the three Kennedys! What is that awful, polluted stench? It made my eyes water on the voyage over, but it is a thousand times worse on this blasted island. I can hardly breathe for the stink of it.
Kenny's got the coals from their slow fires banked up and burning night and day. They converted most of the ship's steel cargo containers into giant smokehouses for processing their meat for travel. It's a long way between veals when they're on the hunt. Sometimes they get their butts kicked by the norms and come up empty on body count. The bastards are fussy about their victuals. Only thing they fussy about. They won't eat anything but people.
An army moves on its stomach. Even a cannibal army.
Do you think the prisoners will help us fight? There seems to be lots more of them than cannies.
They look in real bad shape to me. Beaten down physically and mentally. They know they're gonna die hard. Maybe they don't have the strength left to be of any use to us, especially after dragging those corpses across the island.
If we can get their hands loose, they'll fight all right. They'll fight with everything they've got. They know it's their last chance.
Will that be enough?
If we're triple lucky.
We might well win the battle, but if we don't get our hands on La Golondrina, we can't win the war. We've got to find her, chill her, burn the body, and scatter the ashes. Make sure there's not a single drop of her blood left to make more cure.
Mildred and Jack hauled their corpse up the ship's earthen ramp. When they reached the canted main deck, the canny overseers made them deposit the body beside the others that were already lined up, like trophies of the hunt. They let go of the tow rope, and following a canny's impatient gesture, joined their fellow captives near the gangway on the starboard rail. The ship was a truly colossal craft, 500 feet long, 200 feet wide. It had a pair of king posts aft of midships, and a series of motor-driven gallows-like cranes to lift cargo in and out of the holds. There were six huge hatches in rows of two on the forward deck. There were four more hatches aft of the king posts. The bridge tower had once been painted brilliant white. Now it bled rust top to bottom, in six-story vertical stripes. Atop it sat the squat wheelhouse. The tower's windows were either missing or boarded up. Behind it, the ship's immense 70-foot-high smokestack had caved in on itself. The deck was certainly pitched, but it wasn't so steep that it couldn't be easily climbed, side to side. It had also once been painted a high-gloss white. Now the surface was pitted, stained, leprous with flaking patches of orange. Torches burned at intervals along the rails. Fires burned in empty oil drums along the deck's low side. The canny's excitement disturbed Mildred more than their sheer numbers. It was that frenzied. All in the name of spilled blood. In exaltation of murder. Cannies pressed forward with gun muzzles lowered, packing the captives into an even tighter formation. From this angle, in the leaping firelight, Mildred could see the female figure atop the bridge more clearly. She was definitely raven-haired and tall. She wore a long black dress that exposed thin, pale arms. When she raised her arms over her head, the undersides were red. La Golondrina had opened her veins. Blood dripped off her elbows into vessels held by figures who kneeled in front of her. Mildred looked around. Kenny's hopped and jigged in wild abandon, drunk with promise, with the perceived unstoppable momentum of their cause. Oh yes, they were in a merry, merry mood. What they anticipated was not the big enchilada, not the gift of eternal life, but a pardon from the grisly, tormented death they so richly deserved. While the revelers reveled, they were joined on the deck by birds of a much different feather. These men and women wore fluorescent orange vests, the same kind used by pre-dark road crews, and walked in perfect step, arms swinging, heads held high. Their faces were masks of joy, smiling, cheerful, yet vacant. The vested crew marched straight for the lined-up corpses. They handled the bodies without a shred of respect or dignity. They jerked them around like sides of beef, then started dragging them toward the ship's bow.
Who are they, Junior?
Those are the Happy Meals.
What?
The reference brought memories of Mildred's previous life flooding back. Memories filtered through a screen of present-day horror.
That's what we call them. They're still gnomes. They try to infect themselves with oozies on purpose, hoping to turn canny. Got no real zest for the gore yet, but they force themselves to drink tablespoons of oozy-tainted blood or to gray pus from the goners. They're not the triple stoops you might think. They can see the handwriting on the wall, and they want to join the winning team. They're devoted to our cause, even though they aren't part of it. They're eager to please, too. They'll do anything we tell them with great big smiles on their faces. If they don't manage to get sick after a week or so, we chill them and eat them. That's more where they came from.
Where are they taking the bodies?
To the cooler below decks.
Jack was staring fixedly at his prized colt stuck in the bastard's waistband. Mildred could see the albino's hands twisting and straining at the ropes behind his back, trying to stretch them. Jack's wrists were bloodied by the effort, to no avail.
Got too many bodies on the island to smoke all at once. Not enough smoker houses by half. Takes 3-4 days to do the job right. Besides, deadens have to be shaved, gutted, and bled out. The Happy Meals do all that shit work for us. That's why we keep them alive. We like to age the bodies a while in the cooler, too. Tenderizes the oldies.
On deck, the cannies had begun passing along tin cups of what looked like pure water. Mildred knew it wasn't. It was water tainted with the queen's blood. The flesh-eaters sipped daintily and then handed the cup on to the next in line.
Do you want some of that? It's the real deal. It's the cure. If you drink a big old swig, maybe you'll nip the oozies in the bud. Maybe you'll never get them. But on the other hand, one taste of light golden Drina's blood might just push you over the edge. Instant canny. You want to take that chance?
Mildred wasn't sure, one way or the other. The idea of drinking even highly diluted human blood made her stomach rebel.
You're not going to give it to me no matter what I say, so go fuck yourself.
Junior firmly pushed Mildred and Jack to the rim of the nearest open deck hatch.
Have a look.
They peered down into the deep, steel-walled hold. It was where the canny stored their prisoners. People were running around like ants, and just as helpless.
You can feel the fever coming on strong, can't you? Your pulse is pounding in your head. You know you gotta do something, but you're not quite sure what it is. You'll know real soon. Putting you down there with the gnomes is like dropping a wolf in among the sheep. Of course, with your hands tied behind your back, you won't be able to do them any harm. Ain't that too bad?
What do you want from me?
I want to hear you howl for it.
It?
Meat.
That'll be a cold day in hell, Junior.
Just you wait and see.
A crane lowered a cargo net onto the deck in front of them. Junior drew the python from his waistband.
Get in the net!
Mildred and Jack joined about 30 other captives in the first load. After they stepped into the center of the mesh, the crane lifted up the net, swung it over the open hatch, and lowered it down into the live hold. Except for the people and rows of torches along the walls, the vast enclosure was empty. Its steel sides were at least 100 feet high. They were braced with massive riveted I-beam girders, as was the underside of the main deck. There were a couple of access doors, but they had no knobs or hinges on the inside. About 150 people were sitting or laying on the metal floor. Another 50 or so were milling about aimlessly or pacing like trapped animals. There was no water in sight. The latrine was marked by piles and puddles in the far corner of the hold. It smelled like a human zoo. The Cajuns who had stuck together on the trip down were again gathered in a tight group, this time back to back. Mildred quickly realized that not all the hold's prisoners had their hands tied. Those who had managed to get loose were busy abusing those who hadn't. Mixed in with the docile, scooped up with the honorable and the hard-working, were a handful of cold hearts, the scum of Deathlands. And, with their end in sight, they were hell-bent on taking a few last liberties with the innocent and the defenseless. Last beatings, last robbings, last sex taken by force. They ganged up on the fat Mississippi merchant and the Texan whore and started booting them around. One for the sheer fun of it, the other to do favors. All the females in the hold were fair game to them, even Michelle, the parakeet woman. She was jerked away from her horrified husband while he tried in vain to defend her. The parakeet didn't react to the kidnapping or the threat of gang rape. No screams, no struggles, no tears. As if she weren't even aware of what was going on around her. From the female bodies already lying on the deck, clothes torn away, faces purple from strangulation, women didn't survive the Coldheart's attentions for long.
Don't hurt her. Please.
The Coldhearts closed ranks around their tiny victim. There was nothing for her husband to do but beg.
Have mercy! Don't do this!
There ain't no mercy here, fat man. We're gonna make this little bird sing.
Mildred recognized the type. The ornate facial brandings, the gruesome gridwork of battle scars, the ground-in black dirt and grease on their clothes and skin, the duct tape and plastic bag repair jobs on their pants and boots. They were the lowest form of road trash, highway robbers, vill looters, kidnappers. They were as much human predators as the Cannies. Only up until now, they had left their victims to rot by the side of the road. Back in the day, before the end of civilization, Mildred would have expected to find men like them locked up for life in some state penitentiary's violent offender block, or buried in its potter's field. There were no more penitentiaries, of course, and the entire world had become a potter's field. That the Coldhearts had had the gumption to keep from going over to the Canny side surprised Mildred. Maybe the Cannies already had enough. Happy meals. One of the road trash leered at Mildred. He smacked his stubble-rimmed lips and showed her an alarmingly long red tongue.
That one there looks prime to me. Let's do her, too.
For the second time in 24 hours, Mildred was the focus of unwelcome male attention. This time, she paid it back with interest. When the killer reached out for her with grimy hands, tongue lewdly extended, she snap-kicked him in the chin, driving down with her planted foot, putting everything she had into the upward blow. His eyes rolled in their sockets as the steel-capped toe of her combat boot made solid contact, splitting his lower jaw in two, shattering his front teeth like glass. But not before he bit off the end of his own tongue. His knees buckled. Blood drooled from his lips in long, swaying strands as he dropped unconscious to the deck. A second Coldheart, a man with a shaved head who was missing both ears, lunged at her, but she easily stepped aside and let him fly past. Jack roundhouse kicked the oncoming target in the kneecap. The earless man went down, clutching at his leg with both hands. The Coldhearts weren't done yet, not by a long shot. Killing Mildred and Jack had become a matter of pride. The biggest of the bunch charged her. He stood about 6'3 and weighed at least 250 pounds. Greasy coils of brown hair fell past his white shoulders. His nose had a carved white bone thrust through it. His eyes were small, dark, and full of hate. This time, Mildred pivoted away at the last second, and as the killer swept by, she dropped and leg-whipped him. He landed on his back on the deck. Before he could recover his breath, Mildred's heel stomped his face, turning nose and decorative ornament to bloody pulp. The Coldheart rolled away and staggered up to his feet, clutching his nose as gore spilled out from between his fingers, which left his sternum exposed. Mildred knew better than to give someone that big a second chance to throttle her. She front-kicked him straight in the heart, putting all her weight into it. She felt his ribcage buckle and then snap like a dry branch under her soul. The man's final breath gusted out in a red mist. He crashed to the deck, his legs kicking and trembling in the throes of death.
Snow Wolf! Over here! Quick!
Mildred turned and was stunned to see the Cajuns waving excitedly at Jack. All of them had their hands free. Working back to back, they had managed to untie each other. One of the Cajuns expertly picked out the knot that held Jack's wrists bound together. The albino quickly shook the circulation back into his fingers.
Let's put an end to this crap. We
We got a lot of screwing to do. The mutie's mine.
The barrel-chested man closed in on Jack.
I'm gonna pop out those red eyeballs and stuff them up your pasty white butt.
Shit, he's nothing but a skinny kid. Bring his fucking neck and get it over with.
The stocky cold heart tried. He really tried. When his hands closed, Jack's neck was someplace else.
Huh?
In a blur, Jack had moved behind him. The albino straight punched his adversary in the right kidney. The heavy muscles of the killer's back dulled the shockwave of that first blow, but his face registered sharp, stabbing pain. Jack didn't stop. He didn't step away. He hit the cold heart again and again with consecutive right-hand punches, laying the full-power blows on exactly the same spot.
I thought you said the mutie was yours!
Mildred felt a light touch behind her. When she looked over her shoulder, a female Cajun was working at her bonds. The cold heart tried to whirl to face Jack and bring his hands into the fight, but the albino circled as he turned, shadowing his every move, continuing to pound on that kidney. Mildred knew that after a certain point, even densely layered muscle was no protection from body blows like that. The man couldn't keep his muscle tensed. Under the relentless beating, it would go numb, then slack. And Jack kept hitting him. Piss ran down the cold heart's leg onto the deck. The spiraling dance of pain turned closer and closer to the whole steel wall. Jack was leading. The cold heart was bent double, unable to straighten, unable to lift his right arm. The other road scum didn't step in to help their pal. Some were busy tearing the clothes off the indifferent, unblinking parakeet woman. Maybe the rest were too amused to intervene. Or maybe they wanted to watch him die. Jack grabbed the man by the arm and waist, jerked him off balance, spun him on one foot, and slammed the top of his head into the wall. It was heavy gauge metal. It didn't dent. The cold heart dropped to his knees, blood leaking from both ears. When Jack leaned over his adversary's wide back, he looked small, way too small to have done all that damage. The albino gripped the man's chin with one hand and his opposite shoulder with the other. The movement that came next was too fast for the eye to follow. Jack let the body slump to its side on the deck. Cannies looked down from the rim of the hatch, cheering and jeering the hand-to-hand combat. They didn't give a damn what happened down in the hold. The prisoners were unarmed and they couldn't get out. If the aggressive ones killed each other, it would save them the effort.
Now that's just poor. Come on, let's waste this little shit.
Only one of the road scum deigned to join him, a wiry man with deep creases in his forehead and down his cheeks. The rest were content to remain spectators. Freed herself, Mildred took Jack's back. The cold heart circled, looking for openings. When they found none, they tried to create them with brute force. Mildred blocked a flurry of punches and kicks from the taller man, using her hands, arms, and feet. When he couldn't make a dent in her defense, the scum's face turned red with frustration. The doctor smiled at him, because she knew it would piss him off even more. The killer tried again. This time she let him in, and when he struck for her face, she struck back with a vengeance. The edge of her stiffened forearm slammed into his larynx, crushing it. Stunned, his airway cut off, the cold heart backed away, holding his throat. Behind her, Jack ducked under a haymaker swing and backhanded a rabbit chop to the base of the wiry guy's neck. The blow momentarily disconnected brain from spinal cord, head from legs. The man fell to his knees. Jack kicked him in the head, and when the man dropped to his back on the deck, he kicked him some more. Jack kicked him so hard that one of his eyes popped from its socket. Turning away, the albino looked around for more. None of the scum wanted any part of either of them. The other attacker had collapsed in final spasm, his face purple, eyes bulging and shot with blood, his tongue black and protruding.
Let the woman go, or you're gonna get the same!
To Mildred's delight, the Cajun stepped up and joined ranks with him, maximizing the threat. The Coldhearts knew they couldn't win. They grudgingly moved away from Michelle, leaving her standing there naked, her torn clothes down around her ankles. Mildred pulled the poor woman's dress back up.
Get everybody freed. Untie their hands.
It took only a couple of minutes. The freed prisoners helped release those still bound. The Cannies didn't try to stop them. The only way they could have done that would have been to open fire, and that wasn't called for. Tied or not, the captives weren't going anywhere. A fact that was obvious to everyone in the hold as well.
We gotta find a way out of this pit.
The apparent leader of the Cajuns had a blue-dark shadow of beard, a long nose, and close-set black eyes. A hunk of his left bicep was missing. There were bite marks around the angry wound.
Gotta get a hold of some blasters. Gotta do some damage, soften up the bastards for Chi Luis.
You think he's really coming for us?
You can bet Jack on it.
Mildred craned her head, looking at the edge of the hatch 100 feet up. It might as well have been a mile. There were no foot or handholds for climbing.
How are we gonna get out?
I might know of a way, but there's no guarantee it'll work.
The grounded freighter loomed before Ryan, taller from keel to wheelhouse than a 20-story building. He took in the rusting hull and superstructure, and at the stern its enormous propeller, high and dry. The deck was tilted toward them, revealing hundreds of cannies drumming and dancing. Pillars of black smoke rose from oil drum fires, and torches burning along the rails. Ryan saw the vessel as a military objective, perhaps unattainable, but tangible. At his side, Doc viewed the freighter and the row of skulls leading to it as symbols of something much larger, something more profound, something incarnate.
It is nothing less than Satan's Ark. Having ridden out the unholy storm of the apocalypse, that hellship has safely brought ashore, two by two, every evil known to man. So that as the black polluted waters receded and drained from the land, they might multiply and spread.
Ryan couldn't walk in the old man's cracked knee boots, nor could he see through his ancient eyes. But he understood that Doc was desperately seeking to make sense of something that was at its core senseless. This, by tying together bits of this and that from dusty decades of half-remembered study and reflection. From his private conversations with Mildred, Ryan had learned a little about the mindset of the Victorian age into which Doc Tanner had been born. It was an age of global conquest and subjugation, all in the name of ending savagery and ignorance, and spreading the benefits of civilization to the primitive corners of the earth. In their arrogance, the Victorians defended their crimes against the weak and vulnerable as being not only noble, but ordained by, and in the service of, their God. Confronted in the present by the unspeakable and the unthinkable, Doc had reverted to the unknowable.
Doc, don't go there.
There is a limit to what even I can stomach, dear friend. And we passed that high water mark hours ago.
With that, Doc strode purposefully away from Ryan, walking past the Cajuns to take the point at the head of the line of fighters.
What's wrong with him, Ryan? Is he having another one of his spells?
It wasn't unusual for Doc's brain to slip the odd cog now and again. The double jump forward in time had done him damage. Whether it was his inconsolable grief over the loss of his family, his beloved wife Emily, his treasured children, Rachel and Julian, or whether some trauma related to time travel had injured the tissue of his brain, there was no way of determining. At times, Doc rejected lock, stock, and barrel the new reality that surrounded him. He faded away from the present into memories and fantasies of the world he had been torn from.
Mildred might know what's going on, but she's not here to straighten him out, Christy. Cannies have really gotten under his skin. He's been ranting on about how what they are goes against the rules of his old-time religion.
I might be remembering it wrong, but I don't think the Ten Commandments said anything about not eating your neighbor.
It's a bad joke. We take this world at face value because we don't know any different. For you and me and JB and Jack, they've always been cannies. They're the boogeyman we've had to watch out for since we were little. There weren't any cannies running wild in Doc's day. If they existed anywhere, they were someplace far, far away from his home.
I get it, lover. Maybe we should keep closer tabs on him?
Yeah, but not too close. Moody's in. He won't stand for us looking over his shoulder.
As they approached the side of the ship, they passed within 10 yards of the jumble of tumbled-down cargo containers. Doc made an abrupt right turn, stepped off the path, and walked over to the nearest container. Alarm bells ringing in his head, Ryan followed a few discreet paces behind him. Every one of the corrugated steel boxes was tended by a leather-aproned cook. Every box spewed coils of sickly sweet smoke from the holes hacked in its roof. Piles of cordwood and hickory chips stood at one end or the other, in front of the jury-rigged oil drum fireboxes. A squat lump of a man, sweaty, bare-chested and hairy, looked up from his work as Doc neared. Ignoring the rag of a t-shirt hanging on a hook outside the crude doorway, he wiped the sweat from his brow with the back of his hand. It was stained crimson to the wrist from the basting sauce and the plastic bucket at his boots. As Ryan hurried forward to close the gap, he heard the cook.
If you're looking for the best smoked peeps, you're in the right place. I got a secret recipe. It's all in the sauce.
The canny held out the ragmop basting brush for Doc to try a sample.
I've got a secret as well.
Doc released the ebony sheath on his sword stick and drew out the blade. The canny cook blinked at him, puzzled by the show and tell, but unafraid. What happened next was something he didn't expect. Ryan knew exactly what was coming. He lunged forward, reaching out to deflect Doc's arm. Too late. Without another word, Doc lowered his point and rammed the canny through with a single thrust. Half the length of the rapier blade piercing the bib front of the leather apron. A deft figure-eight twist of the wrist followed, using the leverage of the sword and its keen double edge to neatly sever the major arteries of the cook's heart. The canny's mouth opened, but no words came out. He dropped his baster into the dirt, a look of astonishment on his face. Doc reared back and booted the dying canny off his sword. The cook staggered three steps in reverse, stumbled over the doorway sill, and fell into the smoker box. Ryan darted around Doc, bent, and flipped the legs inside the jam. Then he closed the makeshift door. He looked around, prepared for all hell to break loose. But none of the other cooks had seen what happened. It was over too quickly, and there were no screams to attract their attention. Pure dumb luck.
For nuke's sake, Doc, get a grip!
As Christy, JB, and Sprue joined them, Doc shook the blood off his blade and wiped it clean on the dead cook's t-shirt rag. His eyes flashed.
Is that not what we're here for, to chill them all?
Yeah, but not one at a time if we can help it. If I can't trust you to keep it together until the right moment, I'm gonna take your weapons and tie you up until it's all over.
You would do that to me? You would leave me defenseless against these godless devils?
Damn right I would. To protect your life and ours, I'd triple hogtie you. And I'd have plenty of help doing it.
Doc looked from face to face and saw that they were all of one mind. And it was against him.
I'm gonna give you another chance. No more targets of opportunity. I want your word. I want it now.
Doc sheathed the rapier with a flourish.
This is one battle I will not sit out. I defer to your wishes and stay my hand. You have my solemn word.
While the wagloads of captives slowly climbed the earthen ramp towing their awful burdens, the Cajuns and companions had to wait on the path below. The line leading to the ship advanced in fits and spurts. The companions were standing too close to the hull to see what was going on above. A few minutes later, at the top of the ramp, it sank home to all of them just how outnumbered they were. Without the help of freed prisoners, they had no chance.
At least we've got them all in one place.
And the downside is, they're all in one place.
We've got our work cut out finding Mildred and Jack. Don't see La Golondrina up in the tower either.
If she's up there, she isn't showing herself.
She's up there. I guarantee it.
Ryan walked to the edge of the open hatch and looked down into the hold. The others did the same.
Guess we found out where they keep all the prisoners.
No sign of Jack or Mildred.
Can't see into the corners from here. They could be down there.
Oh, you missed the medicine!
Ryan turned to face the canny hag from the barge. She had been partying hardy. Her hank of white-streaked horsehair had come half unbraided. It stuck out on one side like a busted bale of straw. There were ruddy spots in the centers of her cheeks, and a crust of dried blood in her fan of chin whiskers.
All the cure's gone! There won't be any more until tomorrow.
Is this all of the canny nation?
Nah. Some are down in the crew quarters on B deck, resting up between dinner courses and dancing. The near goners are there too. Too sick to celebrate until the cure kicks in. Better go get yourself something to eat. You're gonna need your strength for the all-nighter.
The hag slapped Ryan hard on the shoulder, then wandered away into the crowd.
You Cajuns never got this far, so we don't have any idea what's below decks. We're gonna have to wreck the ship.
Cheetah Louise nodded in agreement.
On the barge, that Kenny bitch told me there was fuel, oil, and gasoline stored aboard.
Gotta be bunkers of ammo and blasters, too.
We're free to prisoners, get them weapons, take control, then blow the ship.
We can't blow the ship until we have the Queen in hand. We can't risk her getting away in the confusion.
Doc was staring into the flames of a burn barrel, at the knob ends of human long bones glowing in the intense heat. Ryan steered him away. The companions looked up in time to catch the last 30 feet of freefall. A dark figure plummeted from the tower, arms and legs flailing. It vanished behind the heads of the crowd. The Canis didn't let a little warm splatter spoil their mood. They applauded like it was a carny act, then resumed their gyrations. At that point, a crew in orange vests exited a doorway near the bow. They marched like little tin soldiers over to the row of corpses, hitched them up by their heels, and started dragging them back the way they had come.
That's the way down.
The companions and Cajuns followed the draggers along the deck to the doorway. As they waited at the entrance, they could hear the bodies thunking heavily on the metal steps below. The draggers couldn't be bothered carrying them down the stairwell. They descended the stairs in a solid mass. The reek of slaughterhouse was like a billowing toxic cloud. On the second landing, they found a door marked with a stenciled sign, A-Deck. The door opened onto a central torchlit corridor that ran the length of the ship. It offered access to the immense holds on either side. A few Canis walked the metal hallway. When they passed by, they didn't challenge the newcomers. They smiled and nodded at what had to have been a familiar sight. Brethren heading for the ship's armory to replenish their supplies. There was no guard on the armory half-door, and it wasn't even closed. The companions and Cajuns walked right in.